that last primal reserve of fight that all living creatures possess as part of their being. Rhys stood over his bounty from the depths of the Atlantic, reflecting on an irony he'd often pondered when afield hunting and angling. Why did taking the life of a wild creature always give him pause? Maybe it was because there was time. Time to stalk, time to choose, time to contemplate the impact of removing an animal from the ecosystem to nourish his family. Life begets life, and death is a natural part of the cycle. In combat, one kills as quickly and efficiently as possible, and then moves on to the next target. Killing his fellow man was not something that gave Rhys pause. One was to provide sustenance, while the other was to protect the tribe. Both required skill in the act of killing, a capability in which Rhys was exceptionally well-versed. Now was not the time for introspection. It was time to eat. Rhys caught his breath and walked below, retrieving a fillet knife from a magnetic butcher block in the galley and a small bottle of soy sauce from the refrigerator. The long, slender knife pierced the gills, quickly draining its life, before cutting through the tuna's tough skin to reveal the bright red meat beneath. Rhys carved himself a chunk the size of his thumb and doused it with sauce before dropping it into his mouth, the salty meat triggering a pleasure center deep within his brain. Sounds of primitive gratification escaped his lips as he chewed, closing his eyes and saying a silent prayer of thanks to the fish that sustained him. Rhys must have eaten 2 pounds of the fish before his hunger was satisfied. He began the slow work of slicing the yellowfin tuna into thick steaks, putting each into a Ziploc bag destined for either the refrigerator or the freezer. The intake of real food changed his dark mood dramatically. All he needed now was a night of solid sleep undisturbed by the nightmares that tortured his soul. Rhys took a deep breath and took stock of his surroundings. He sat barefoot on the deck of an expensive sailboat on the open ocean with nowhere to be and no one to answer to. The sun was shining, a steady breeze was blowing, and he had enough food to sail anywhere. He was back on course and both sheets were tight and clean. Most people trapped in cubicles would cut off their big toes to trade places with him right now. If only his family were here to enjoy it with him. With varying degrees of success, he'd managed to suppress the memory, but in this moment of introspection, he thought of Katie. He remembered her bound and beaten on the floor of the Secretary of Defense's Fisher's Island mansion, his old friend and teammate, Ben Edwards, standing over her with a detonator in his hand, debt cord wrapped around her neck. Rhys had shot and killed the SecDef and her financial sector benefactor before turning to Ben and putting a 5.56 round into his face, taking the last names off his list. Those responsible for the deaths of his SEALs on a remote Afghan mountain and the murder of his wife and child in their Coronado, California home were now in the ground. You need to find Katie and explain it. You knew that Ben hadn't primed that debt cord, didn't you? Didn't you? He closed his eyes and heard her last words to him before he headed for the secondary extract alone. Rhys, how did you know Ben didn't have that detonator connected? How did you know he wouldn't blow my head off? He remembered the pleading, almost confused look in her eyes, the rain pelting down around them, wind howling, the Pilatus aircraft engine ready to propel her down the runway to safety as he told her the truth. Or did he? I didn't, he'd said, shutting the door and sprinting toward the marina. I didn't. Chapter 6. Al-Hasakah, Syria, November. A new Datsun hatchback stopped at the curb in front of President Haddad's home, and two camouflage-clad figures holding Kalashnikovs climbed out while a third stayed behind the wheel of the idling car. The one closest to Nizar's sniper hide was a female, her dark hair hanging down the back of her uniform in a neat ponytail. He had planned on shooting only the president, but then decided that it was her day to die as well. Despite carrying assault rifles made in Eastern Europe, the president's bodyguards wore surplus American chest rigs to hold their ammunition, no doubt provided by the CIA. Neither the male nor female YPG troops wore any headgear, and there was no sign of body armor. The male soldier stopped in front of the iron gate and turned to cover the road while the female was buzzed through and approached the home's front door. Within moments, a man in his 60s wearing a tan business suit stepped from the home and nodded to the female bodyguard. He was balding with white hair and a beard that he wore neatly trimmed. He looked like many other men in this city of nearly a quarter million, but Nizar had been studying his photo and recognized the face immediately as that of President Masur Haddad. His finger moved to the curved steel trigger. Nizar's view of the target was obscured by the female soldier who walked directly in front of Haddad. Both she and the closer guard searched for threats as their principal crossed his small front yard toward the gate. They were well-trained and dedicated, but oblivious to the deadly sniper poised to strike. The female opened the gate and stood aside to let Haddad pass through, giving Nizar a clear shot. He reacted quickly, firing a 9x39mm round as soon as the scope's reticle settled on the president's face. Even suppressed and subsonic, the shot was loud inside the confined space of the truck. Because Nizar didn't want the muzzle of his rifle to be visible from the outside, he kept it well behind the opening in the block, which contained most of the sound inside his makeshift hide. The soldiers 100 meters away heard nothing but the sickening sound of a heavy bullet slapping flesh as Nizar's shot found its mark. The full metal jacket SP-5 bullet passed through President Haddad's eye and exited the back of his skull, taking a sizable amount of brain matter with it. Nizar didn't pause to admire his shot since he knew where it had gone the moment the trigger broke. He moved the selector switch on the odd-looking rifle to full auto and put a burst of rounds into the female soldier before moving to engage the male. The president was barely on the ground before his loyal bodyguards joined him, both writhing in agony as they quickly bled to death from the significant trauma to their vital organs. Nizar shifted his body to the right to allow him a better angle on the driver, who was stepping out of the Datsun to help his wounded comrades and their principal. Another suppressed full-auto burst from the Russian weapon put him down, too, though he was able to crawl behind his vehicle before drowning in his own blood. Nizar repeated a command 3 times into the Russian-made R-187P1 handheld radio. Communications were shit in most of Syria, but the Interior Ministry saw to it that his unit had the finest gear that their benefactor nation could provide. Seconds later, he heard a series of violent explosions. Assets had driven car bombs to strategic locations around the city and detonated them on his command. Not only had these explosions caused significant casualties among both the local civilian and military populations, but they also would provide a chaotic diversion and give Nizar a chance to escape the city. He pushed his way through the false wall at the back of the truck, sending concrete blocks tumbling to the ground in front of him. He had loaded a fresh magazine into his rifle and held it at the ready as he climbed from the truck and moved toward the cab. With blasts still rocking the city around him, Nizar unlocked the truck, stashed his rifle muzzle down on the seat next to him, and fired up the Kia. He watched Al-Hasaka erupt from peace into panic in real time, like a beehive that had been poked. Sirens wailed, cars honked and drove wildly, both toward and away from the blasts, and pedestrians, many of them refugees from embattled cities to the south, darted in every direction. Their little democratic utopia had been shattered. Nizar steered around the cars and crowds carefully, not because he cared for them, but so as not to disable his only means of transportation. The farther he moved from the center of the city where the blasts were concentrated, the calmer the situation became, people's faces expressing more curiosity than fear by the time he reached the roundabout that connected to the highway. He tensed up as he saw what looked like a military roadblock ahead, but he relaxed once he saw that they were only stopping traffic heading into the city. Leaving the narrow streets behind, he accelerated past the roadblock on the number 7 highway and drove south, out of town. Chapter 7. Basel, Switzerland, November. Few men addressed Vasily Andrenov by his given name. Almost everyone addressed him as Colonel, the highest rank he'd achieved before the Soviet Union collapsed. To the intelligence services, who were aware of his existence, he was known as Kukonik Mastip, Puppet Master. This apt description was the result of his years of service in Russia's main intelligence directorate, better known as the GRU. If there was a Soviet-backed revolution, insurrection, assassination, or coup in the 1970s or 80s, chances were that Puppet Master was the one pulling the strings. Nicaragua, Afghanistan, Angola, and Mozambique all carried his fingerprints and those of his team of advisors. Unfortunately for Andrenov, he was not in the good graces of the current Russian regime and was forced to live as an expat due to unproven suspicions concerning his involvement in the assassination of a former defense minister. Basel had been Andrenov's home for the past decade, ideally located to maximize access to the power centers of Western Europe while taking advantage of the privacy and non-extradition practices of the Swiss Federation. Andrenov also liked to be close to his considerable wealth, all of which was tucked into the world's most secure banking system, just down the road. His line of work had left him with numerous enemies, both state and non-state, so he kept travel to an absolute minimum. When someone as wealthy as the colonel needed to see a physician, banker, or prostitute, they came to him. However, despite a lifetime of sin, depravity, and merciless violence, Andrenov saw himself as a devout Orthodox Christian, and the traditions of his faith did not make house calls. When he left his embassy-like walled compound in the Dalba neighborhood, it was to visit St. Nicholas Orthodox Church on Amabachstrasse, something he did like clockwork the one Sunday each month when services were held there. The colonel's devotion to the church had not prevented him from masterminding the assassination of Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero in 1980, or the subsequent massacre at his funeral. Those events served the greater good of delegitimizing the government of El Salvador, which in turn served Mother Russia. Andrenov's religious dedication was more nationalistic than spiritual in nature. He saw the Russian Orthodox Church as the core of Russian culture, without which the nation would still be factions of warring tribes riding the steppe. Who else could have defeated the mongrels to the east, the Nazis to the west, the Japanese on the seas, and the mighty United States in the Third World battlefields of the Cold War? Inept government, rampant corruption, and an ethnic death spiral of low birth rates and short life expectancies had brought the tide of Russia's greatness to an ebb. Andrenov's calling was to see that greatness wash back over its banks from Istanbul to Paris. Andrenov folded his coat collar upward to protect him from the bitter cold and nodded to Yuri Vatutin to open the door, another man, part of the very capable security detail comprised of former members of the FSB's Alpha Group that Yuri led, opened the back door of the armored Mercedes S600 Guard, idling its 530-horsepower V12 in the gated circular driveway. Andreyanov lowered himself into the heated leather seat as the door closed behind him. Yuri took his spot in the passenger seat, his suppressed AK-9 between his knees, and spoke into the microphone at his wrist to alert the men in the lead and chase vehicles that it was time to move. The wrought iron gates opened, the vehicle barrier was lowered, and the well-armed and armored motorcade sped toward Sunday Mass. Chapter 8. Aboard the Bitter Harvest, Atlantic Ocean, November. Most city dwellers have no concept of what the night sky really looks like, as much of the sea of stars and planets above is obscured, to the point of invisibility, by the lights and distractions of civilization. On a cloudless night in the middle of the Atlantic, the light show was spectacular. Reese had always been fascinated with the heavens, particularly the fact that tens of thousands of years ago, humans would have looked up with the same sense of wonder. Through centuries of change and progress, the skies were a constant. He'd told his daughter Lucy to look at the sky at night and pick out the brightest star when he was away, telling her he would be looking at the same one, so they would always be together. He looked up towards Sirius, the brightest in a brilliant array of stars that spanned the sky from horizon to horizon. "Daddy's here, baby girl." He wondered about Liz, whether she'd taken the escape plan he'd set up for her. He hoped she had, but also knew that she might be stubborn enough to stick it out in the States. Liz wasn't the running away type. He knew Marco was fine. Guys like Marco find a way to dance between the raindrops. He assumed that Katie's status as a journalist, along with the hard evidence he'd given her, would keep her out of jail, though he was still worried about her. She had come into his life like a guardian angel sent by his father. In another time, under different circumstances, he would have liked to know her better. Too bad he was a grieving widower. Too bad he was a domestic terrorist. Too bad he was terminally ill. Reese's thoughts were broken by a set of bright lights on the horizon. The object was on an angular path that brought it closer and closer to the boat. Whatever it was looked massive and was lit up like something out of a space movie. With his binoculars, Reese confirmed it was a cruise ship, hundreds of passengers enjoying a break from reality. Wonder where they are going. Sailing solo across the open ocean was an incredibly lonely experience, only compounded by the turmoil and loss of the previous few months. In spite of the circumstances, Reese also felt an undeniable sense of freedom. In this moment, fueled by the wind and guided by the stars, he could command his own destiny. There were no schedules. There was no destination. He had no responsibilities to anyone. For the first time in as long as he could remember, there was no mission. Though it was liberating to not have a plan of any kind, he couldn't just bob around in the ocean forever under the specter of impending death. With the end of his life looming, he still felt compelled to keep moving forward. Frogmen don't quit. Never ring the bell. Well, where to then, Reese? There was a place, though the odds of making it there were slim. It would at least give him something to do while he waited to pass over to Valhalla. Reese had never paid much attention to the odds. Why start now? It was a destination that was about as far off the grid as a human could venture. A leftover culture, a human time capsule, from a time and place that the West had long